Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale, and I'd like to welcome you to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening to Voice of Vashon, webcast in real time at voiceofvashon.org, also available on archive and broadcast on Comcast Channel 21. Today, I'm pleased as punch, to use an old but excellent saying, to be interviewing Sarah Collins Honenberger. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me.
Welcome. Thank you.
As a quick reminder to our listeners, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is a new show here at Voice of Vashon designed with a simple goal in mind. How is it, I ask my authors, that they seek to use their fiction, memoir, or poetry to affect or inspire social change? Sarah, you are the first author I've had on the show who fictionalizes true stories. Could you explain a little bit about what that means to our listeners?
Sure. What you do, you fictionalize true stories for a number of reasons, but the main one of which that has affected me or motivated me is that the true stories I am trying to tell are very difficult for the people who lived through them to tell. And so it's easier if I can change a little bit who they are, where they were, and they have some privacy protection in that regard.
Right, right, compared to like a journalistic story or something where they'd be right out there in front of everybody as who they really were.
Right. I don't want to have it be Oprah at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I want it to be something that's easy to read, accessible for people to understand, but not violating somebody's privacy.
Right. So today we'll be mostly talking about two of your novels, White Lies and Catcher Caught, each of which was inspired by what I would call examples of the human condition, the struggle we all face when life is not so simple.
Yes, they're medical controversies, really, things that people, a lot of people have to face, but you might never have to face. And so it's interesting to read about it, but it also helps people who might have to deal with that situation.
Right, right. That's a beautiful blend of being able to reach out to different people. So this is going to be a full hour-long show, and we'll be covering a lot of interesting and inspiring aspects of your work, your process, and the issues faced by our listeners and the people whose stories you've written about. To get us started, could you share with us your background and what was going on prior to meeting the woman whose court case is the central story of White Lies?
Yes, I was a small-town attorney. I moved from Massachusetts, where I grew up, to Virginia because I fell in love with a Virginia gentleman. And he and I both practiced together for almost 30 years. And then we went into separate careers. Mine was writing fiction. But one of these cases, I have lots and lots of stories about families in Virginia because that's what I did, was family law in my little farming community. But this particular story, the character Lacey Stonington was a real person who had come to me for help on a pretty mundane matter and then came back to me years later on a much more emotional issue. That is her child who had been injured by a vaccine, but she had never known what had caused his seizures.
Right. And I have to say, the way you wrote the story, it's like I feel like I would want to be able to meet Lacey, or that I would want to be able to say to her, you know, it's if you're just reading a fictional story and you know it's fictional and they're not real people, they can still mean a lot to you as characters. But it's interesting, the back of my mind, I just know that Lacey, or her real name, whoever she is out there in the world. And it's very fascinating for me to have that experience as a reader.
She's like lots and lots of mothers, and the book is about motherhood and about friendship between women who have different backgrounds, who happen to run up against each other in a small town, which happens in lots and lots of places all over the world. But she was such an unusual person because despite all the sadness in her life and the terrible things that she lived through, she was upbeat, happy, cheerful, just an amazing person. And so she deserved to have her story told.
Yeah, as her son did as well. So writers often talk about the inciting incident in a novel. For those of you who are just readers and not writers, this is that moment when the author is like, okay, how mean can I be to this character, and what awful difficulty can I put them into, you know, so that they're going to have to show their ability to stand up and fight the good fight, so to speak. So the experience fantastical or traumatic or perhaps utterly confusing, which leads that character to take action and gets the story rolling, is an interesting thing for authors to talk about. But for you, now as an author of several published books, it seems that meeting Lacey in the following 4 years served as your inciting incident, launching you into this second career of being a writer.
It seems that way because this is the first book that was published, but I actually had another story that I wrote first over 5 years' worth of Saturday mornings when my husband took the kids to play soccer, about a rapist wife who insisted he was innocent and maintained that insistence throughout the entire trial and his incarceration, even when evidence came in that he had committed other crimes earlier. And she fascinated me, too, as a woman who was so sure of herself and her love for her husband that I wrote that book first. But most novelists have a first book that is in the closet that will never see the light of day because it is so badly written. That's where mine is. Too many adverbs, too overwritten, too emotional.
So that book never made it to press, but it was...
No,
it was your Saturday...
It'll have to be rewritten.
Your Saturday morning experiences, exactly. Oh, that's so funny because, you know, my novel that's currently in revision, it's, you know, same thing. It was like, okay, you know, they would see me at Cafe Luna and I'd be sitting there in front of my computer madly typing away while my husband took care of the kids. Yeah. Okay, so the full title of your book, and we're going to also talk about your second book today, but the full title of your book is White Lies, A Tale of Babies, Vaccines, and Deception. Yet, you are supportive of vaccines in general. And I believe Lacey is as well. So that's an interesting title.
Yes, I wanted... the thing is, when I wrote this novel, there were no fiction books out about people with vaccine-injured children. There were two medical tomes, treatises, really, that were very difficult to read and a very detailed and complicated. And I think that, and it was early in the vaccine episode because they started the vaccines in 69. Lacey came to me 2 or 3 years after they started the fund. She was one of the very early cases of families filing. And so there wasn't a lot out there. Now there's, I mean, you can put into your computer any word at all and it'll come up with the vaccine controversy and issues on both sides. But then it was very unusual. And so I wanted people to understand with the novel that that's what it was about. It was about what had happened to a baby and what the government had done and the drug manufacturers had done.
Right. And this is, as you know, definitely something that many of us who wish to encourage conversation about the topic of vaccine science and how we use vaccines for best effect and how we honor their strength and the benefit as well as the strength and the potential for rare, hopefully very, very rare harm. This apparent dichotomy is one that a lot of people seem to have trouble with. You know, how do you help people understand that you can support vaccinations and yet also not have a blind faith in them?
Well, it's like any parenting skill, really, or any skill you develop over your lifetime. You want a child to learn how to use a knife, and you give him a very dull table knife to start with when he's 6 or 7. You don't give it to him when he's 3 months old, and you don't give him the sharpest knife in the knife block. And so it's the same thing with vaccines. You have to educate yourselves, and there are circumstances where it's appropriate, and there are circumstances where it's not appropriate or it needs to be fine-tuned for the particular situation. And that's all I'm saying is more information is always better than less information. That's my motto.
I would agree completely. So my co-writer and I have a series of articles that we write in a local paper called The Loop. And we recently wrote an article about the relatively short history of vaccine science. It's really only been about 100 years. Government involvement and legal proceedings, which eventually evolved into the current state of affairs. And I was wondering if you could elaborate in your words on what the current system looks like and what people are dealing with if they're unfortunate enough to have an adverse reaction, which is rare and unusual.
Okay, you mean as far as where they would go for assistance in taking care of an injured child?
Yeah, a little bit about how the current system is structured.
Okay. Well, that the system, actually, the actual process hasn't changed much. In other words, you hire a lawyer to represent you before the Court of Claims, which is a special federal court, so it's nationwide and in Washington, and you and they file papers on your behalf, and they file evidence on your behalf, and they schedule a hearing on your behalf, and then you bring your medical expert to that hearing. And unlike a trial, it can be done in a lot of less formal ways, and it's not necessarily the way you see on TV where you go one day, you have your witnesses lined up, they testify one at a time, and then the judge makes a ruling. It often can be done with a lot of pre-filing of papers and back and forth between the doctors and the court, and arguments made in writing by the lawyer. So there's a lot more paperwork than actual trial time. It's not really a trial, it's an administrative hearing. It's a little less pressurized. It's a little easier for a layman to understand what the questions are and what the process is when they're actually there. But there still is a decider, a Court of Claims special master, he's called, instead of a judge, and he makes the decision very often or almost always not the day you give your testimony about what happened when your child had the adverse reaction, or the day that the doctor testifies, or the two doctors testify, usually one for the family and one for the government. He often makes, the special master often, almost always, makes his decision later after he's read everything and has had time to think about it and compare it to other situations that he knows of, other cases, that kind of thing. So right. It's a long, drawn-out process, and it often takes 2-3 years. It started out very differently. It's in 1986. It was very much meant to be allow the manufacturers to go forward and create new vaccines without having to worry about having to take care of the injured children or the injured vaccine recipients.
Right.
But they changed that over time to make it much more complicated, in part because there are so many more people filing, which is logical because there are so many more vaccines, and so there are that many more people that may believe that they've suffered an adverse reaction that entitles them to some kind of help taking care of the injured.
Right. So in general, you would say that there's general agreement amongst the medical profession, vaccine makers, and within the government that there will always be some adverse reactions, whether it's caused by something that went wrong with the vaccine or whether it's an individual who has something unique to them, like an egg allergy, or, for example, if you are allergic to yeast, if you have a severe allergy to yeast, it says very clearly on the Gardasil website, do not get our vaccine. So there's not really disagreement about whether adverse reactions are going to happen. And that's why this whole system was set up as a way of allowing us to achieve the greater good for society while not ignoring the people who happen to get injured along the way.
It's actually a contract. I mean, the government's just like any contract to buy a car or buy a house. The government says, we're going to mandate vaccines. We're going to offer them to you as an opportunity to keep your child or yourself safe from a particular disease. We have done and insisted on certain kinds of research, and our Food and Drug Administration has approved certain drugs to be used for these vaccines. And we know from the studies that there are, to the best of our ability with the medical knowledge at the time, that there are going to be a certain number of children that are going to be injured by this vaccine, and they're going to be in a variety of ways. So originally when the fund was set up in 1986, they had a table of injuries, and literally if your child had the choking injury that was described in section XXX, then you could go to the vaccine court and say, my child had the vaccine, the next day he had this choking injury, and you had your doctor to verify what happened, and they would help you with money to take care of that child, depending on how much help he needed. But as the process went on, the government made it harder and harder to link those injuries, and they made the table of injuries much smaller and they required more outside evidence to link the two things. So it got harder and harder for families to show that they were one of those statistical injuries.
Which partly may be the result of, as you say, like changing science. So, you know, as we gain more scientific ability to evaluate cause and effect or the potential for correlation or whatever, it makes sense that it needs to be sort of a fluid system. But it's funny because last night when I was thinking about this interview, I'm like, okay, so, you know, this seems very simple. You've got this great tool. It does great things. Every once in a while, it's not going to work so well. We know this. So we'll set up a system so that those people can be found and discovered and then given support. So what could go wrong? You know, I'm like, you know, what could be wrong? I went, oh, wait, well, we're dealing with humans. Right. Okay. That's what can go wrong. You know?
Right.
So.
Well, the problem is that when they make that promise and they say, we know there are some dangers to this and we're going to take care of you if you're hurt by the dangers to this, because 98% of the people are, in the case of the DPT vaccine, which is in my book, White Lies, the pertussis, the whooping cough part of that.
Right.
We know there's going to be 1 in 100,000 that are going to have severe enough seizures to be brain damaged. And we're willing to take care of those children. That's the contract we make. And if you accept that contract and vaccinate your child, then you should be able to get that recovery. But
right.
Then when they make it more difficult and they start, you know, hedging their bets, especially in a system where there are billions of dollars in this fund. I mean, every single vaccine, every single parent who vaccinates their child is paying in, I think it's 76 cents a shot
mm-hmm.
to the fund for every time their child has a shot. So there's billions of dollars in the fund. There's no real reason why, if they set up an adequate screening system, they couldn't screen and pay the families. But
right.
I don't really understand, and that's partly why I wrote the book, why the government was so afraid that they had to make the system more and more restrictive.
Right. And the pertussis that you're talking about that Lacey's son received, and I think it was 1968, was it?
69, yeah.
69.
They started the vaccines in 68. He was
right.
In 1969. Mm-hmm.
So that was the whole cell pertussis vaccine, which... Interesting. I'll let you clarify this yourself, but my impression had been that the world possessed the whole cell pertussis vaccine and that that was the best available, and that when that started having problems, and there were problems in many different countries, that there was an effort to find a safer vaccine, which became the acellular vaccine, and that that is what America then transitioned into using because... They were like, okay, we have a problem. Let's find a better one. There you go. But you told me something about the acellular pertussis vaccine actually being available way back when?
Yeah, the United States didn't require the acellular version until 1996. And one of the deceptions,
mm-hmm.
well, in 1972, Sweden and Japan, way back, you know, 4 years after they started requiring the DPT vaccine with American children and children around the world, Japan and Sweden developed the acellular version and started giving it to their children. And the United States decided, the government and the drug manufacturers, for whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
decided that they weren't going to require that. They were going to allow the cellular version to still continue to be given.
Mm-hmm.
And it took another, you know, 14 years or 16 years for them to finally agree that they should give the acellular version.
Well,
right. When I did my research, I went and talked to Diane Harper, who is the doctor at Dartmouth, who did a lot of the vaccine testing for Merck and the other drug companies.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I said, you know, my suspicion is, just from everything I've read in the legislative history and the congressional record and what senators said and what drug manufacturer witnesses said at those hearings, my suspicion is that the government didn't want to require it in the United States because it costs $12 more a shot, and they would end up having to pay for the Medicaid babies, and they didn't want to incur that expense. And Diane Harper said, you're exactly right. That's exactly why they didn't require it.
Wow.
And that was amazing to me, and it was something
yeah.
I felt like I should put in the book. That parents should know that their government wasn't being completely straight with them. And for maybe a valid reason. I mean, obviously expense is a reason. I mean, you don't necessarily, you know, buy the most expensive version of whatever it is you're looking for. But at the same time, if you're going to fight the families that need the help, you ought to be willing to say, you know, we understand we could have less injuries if we switch to this, but it's a cost factor, and we're not ready to impose that cost on American families or on the social services system.
Right. Right, which would be really great if there was, you know, advertising in the doctor's office that said, you know, you can pay more money and get this option or pay less. Or if it said, we're giving you this because we're trying to save money, you know, but they, of course, don't bring that up. And so the impression that the average, you know, parent walking into a doctor's office who is waiting to be informed by their medical, their chosen medical professional about what's the best choice for my child, well, you know, the best choice may be something that's not available in your country because of a cost factor. Probably the doctor isn't going to be motivated to tell you that. So you just end up not knowing. And then,
well, it's a very sticky emotional issue. If you think about it, it's a social issue, a cultural issue. Are you going to tell the families that can't afford it that there's a better remedy, but you can't help them with it? And so they're going to have to put their children more at risk because they can't afford to pay $12. Mm-hmm. Extra for the shot. And that's, Americans don't like that argument. You know, they've never liked that argument.
Right.
It's hard. It's a very emotional question. How do you decide who deserves to get the safer shot?
And when it comes to money playing a role, people get really uncomfortable. It's funny because I've had people be sort of critical about maybe how public health is expressing something. And I'll say, whoa, now hold on. You know, you've got really good people who work in public health, and they're doing the best they can with the dollars they are given by the government. And if their goal is to, you know, get to point R in the alphabet, they want to get to point R, and they only have so much money, they have to find a way to advertise as effectively as possible. And a lot of times they don't want to cause questions because then you have to spend money answering those questions, essentially. So they're not motivated because they're deceitful and sneaky and they're like, oh, you know, I'm gonna hide this from you. It's more like, I only got so many dollars and I'm trying to reach my goal, so we're going to simplify the advertising. I don't like it that that's how it happens, but it doesn't mean that people working in public health are actually nefarious or bad. They're just stuck, like a lot of us are, between a rock and a hard place and doing the best they can.
Sure, and they consider themselves the experts and they know more than the average person. And they are going to say, you know, really, vaccines have saved lives and vaccines have eliminated diseases. And, you know, we think they're a good thing. And, you know, unless you know something specific that tells us we shouldn't give it to you, we want you to have it.
Right. Now, so I'm watching the clock here. We're going to have plenty of time, it looks like, to cover everything. A while back, I was doing some interesting research, and the FDA has been quoted a number of times as stating that only about 10% of adverse reactions are ever reported, which makes sense since some adverse reactions are going to be mild, some are going to be moderate, and then the very rare ones are going to be severe. So what I find interesting is Lacey's story. When her son was injured, the reaction sort of course, this is back when, frankly, I don't think doctors really had a lot of respect for moms in the late 60s. So she wasn't like really sat down and fully informed of what was going on when her son was injured. At least that was my takeaway from how the story was written. And that it was years later, if you could go into a little bit about how she came to this revelation about what had actually happened to her son and the impression she had carried through her whole life based upon, you know, what doctors had or had not mentioned. And I just find that really interesting how the medical community, they're caught in the middle as well. How do they respond, you know, when there's an adverse reaction and the stories of parents who were told by their doctor, oh, that's normal. Your baby's been screaming for 6 hours. You know, just don't worry about it. It'll be fine in the morning. So what's your impressions around where the doctors get stuck?
Well, certainly what happened with Lacey was they didn't tell her it was the vaccines. They talked among themselves. There are scenes in the book where she comes across the doctors talking, and she knows they're talking about her Danny, her baby, because he spent so much time in the hospital. He had actually had two shots. He had a follow-up shot, and he had adverse reactions to the second shot as well. But the first one were the severe seizures, and of course, since he was little, it was at that point hard to tell how much permanent damage he would have, and that, of course, became very clear as he grew older and didn't grow up mentally or even physically to a certain extent. He has very gnarled hands, and there's a lot of things that have, you know, biologically that didn't develop either after those two shots. But when she went back to get, what happened is Barbara Lowe Fisher, who is in charge of the National Vaccine Information Center and try to get the truth out about vaccines and to have people consider both sides. She's become a regular witness in congressional hearings. She's really the number one advocate and has been the early 70s. But my client, Lacey, and the fictional woman in the book, The Mother of the Baby, sees that show that Barbara Lowe Fisher did in 1982 called Vaccine Roulette. And she watches that show on TV and says, you know, that sounds exactly what happened to my Danny.
Mm-hmm.
And then she comes to see the only lawyer she knows, who's handled her no-fault divorce from Danny's father years before, and to whom she never told that she had a baby by that marriage because she was so embarrassed and ashamed because she thought she had done something that caused her child to choke and have seizures.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctors had never told her that it was not anything she did. It was the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And then 20 years later, when we start investigating the case and getting ready to go to the compensation fund and make a claim for help, we can't get the medical records from the doctors, and it's not their fault, but it's just the different medical entities have folded and, you know, stored things. And she goes in person to try to find the old pediatrician, and he's been replaced by a younger doctor who was actually there at the time but not her treating physician. And the first thing he says to her when she says, "Do you remember me?" he says, "Oh, yes, you're the mother of the DPT baby."
Mm-hmm.
So they knew all along, but they just never told her. So she lived with this 20 years of guilt, and that makes the story very emotional as well, because she's had to think that she caused it, and so that was a very hard thing for her to have to deal with all those years and to get over, because she had this very severely injured child.
Right. Right. So there's that piece. And then what I find really fascinating is I was being interviewed on this issue, actually, a number of years ago. And there was the interview, and there was another woman who was the one who was in charge of, like, the lights and the camera and stuff like this. It was a video interview. I don't do written interviews anymore. The one time I did an interview with a reporter who wrote notes and didn't record anything, she completely misstated me. It was so shocking. When the article came out, I was like, if I had a recording of what I had said, I could totally have taken her to court. It was so awful. So at that point, I said, I learned my lesson, and I will do nothing except audio, video, recording from now forward. And so this woman who was in charge of the camera and the lights, at the end, after hearing everything, she said, you know, I feel like I can actually tell you what happened. And the woman who was her teammate, the journalist, was like, knew the story. And she's like, I usually can't talk about this with people because they jump all over me, or they jump to assumptions or whatever. But her child has developed a classic condition that is always, it's basically a vaccine-related condition. And she was impacted very quickly, you know, and all of the specialists just basically told her, yes, this is the type of condition she has. This is known to be caused by the vaccine. This is what's going on. And this is a lifelong condition. We've never known anyone to recover from this. And it's a form of arthritis that afflicts young children. And they said to her, you need to report this. Your daughter will deal with this her whole life. It's going to cost her money. It's going to lessen the quality of her life. It will never go away. You need to report this. There's no question that this is linked to the vaccines. And then they handed her and her husband this pile of like paperwork stuff. And of course, at this time, she and her husband are scrambling around, going to, you know, one specialist after another, trying to figure out treatment. You know, their child's in massive pain. How do they deal with that? And they looked at the requirements, all they'd have to do in order to file and to move forward in that direction. And they actually just threw their hands up in there and said, you know what? We give up. You know, we're going to focus on our daughter right now, of course, like all parents want to focus on their suddenly injured child who was in perfect health, you know, 3 weeks earlier or whatever. And I said, you never filed. She's like, no, the doctors really wanted us to, and we just couldn't handle it. It was so intense what would be required of us in order to go that route that we decided we had to focus our resources and our attention on our daughter.
Well, and that's a really very accurate depiction. I mean, Lacey took care of Danny for 2 years by herself. Her husband walked out. When she finally got sick and had a gallbladder issue and had to go in the hospital, there was nobody in her family or her friends who would come and take care of him. And the therapist was the one that actually watched Danny while she was having her surgery. Mm-hmm. And that's not actually in the book, but that's a true statement. And when she finally agreed, based on her doctor's advice, to put Danny in the state hospital, she weighed 88 pounds. I mean, she couldn't pick him up. I mean, he was 2 years old, and he couldn't walk, and he couldn't help himself, and she had to carry him around, and she couldn't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm, right.
It's tragic. But you do, of course, you get very caught up in it, and your child is your first priority. And it was emotional for her 20 years later. I mean, she almost didn't go to the court hearing because she was too terrified.
And even then, and it was a tremendous amount of effort. You all as a group had, I mean, it's amazing. So I'm not going to give away anything about this story. White Lies is truly, even if I wasn't interested in the subject, it's a really, really enjoyable read. As a quick reminder to our listeners, you're tuning in to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on Voice of Vashon at voiceofvashon.org. My name is March Twisdale, and I'm talking today with Sarah Collins Honenberger, author of several books, including White Lies, A Tale of Babies, Vaccines, and Deception, and also Catcher Caught. And I do feel in the current environment that I have to throw out there right now for our listeners that Sarah and the woman whose son was injured by the DPT shot in 1969 are both supportive of vaccines in general, that you can be aware of what's going on and you can ask questions and you can still be pro-vaccines in general. It does not make you an anti-vaccine person. And that is one of the things happening right now in the media is if you ask any questions, you're immediately attacked. It's very interesting environment that we're dealing with right now. So there is a burning question that I've had for almost 17 years now, ever since I became pregnant with my first son and began to consider the many decisions I'd be making on his behalf. Whenever we look around, the world is just waiting to offer us challenging and painful issues that need our sincere and heartfelt attention. I mean, there's just all sorts of stuff going on. And yet, as I was just alluding to, when it comes to discussing the realities of vaccine science, most conversations seem to get swept away in a torrent of emotionally laden stuff. I mean, it's like there's defensiveness, and it is amazing how horrific. I wish I had some quotes from some of the articles out there, just the bashing that is going on. I'd love to hear what you think might be causing community conversation around such a powerful and valuable medical tool as vaccines to short circuit. You know, what is going on? What are people scared of? What is the problem?
Well, I think partly it's because we still have generations alive that lived through the flu epidemic and polio and lost siblings to polio. And they know that the vaccines have created miracles. I mean, the polio vaccine has basically eradicated polio. The tuberculosis vaccine, I mean, there are all kinds of diseases that our current children are not confronting and our grandchildren are mm-hmm. not confronting because of vaccines. And so the knee-jerk reaction is, you know, these are miracle drugs and guaranteed, and why would you ever consider not getting them?
Mm-hmm.
So my children had vaccines. My grandchild has had her vaccines. But there are all kinds of ways to fine-tune that depending on your family history.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's no reason if you have a family history where people have had adverse reactions to vaccines or you have a cousin who has Asperger's syndrome, you might want to wait, or you might want to say to the doctor, I'm willing to pay for a separate dose so that it's not batched and it's not bundled and it's one disease at a time. And I can watch and make sure that the reaction is not severe enough and before I give the second one. And I'll wait till my child is a little older to give that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can make an informed decision. And informed decisions are really what America is about. I mean, what we said was we don't want a king telling us what to do, when to do it, without our having a say in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so why Americans object to that, it is very complicated and hard to understand. But well, I think it has to do with the vaccine miracle.
You know, I think that you're making an excellent point there because, for example, we have vehicle malfunctions, drug recalls, children dying from, you know, raw juice that they drink somewhere, undercooked eggs, tainted meat, even toys sold at Christmas, like those small magnetic BB toys that ended up causing a few deaths because children would swallow them and they would, you know, get in the intestines and cause major problems. In all of these cases where a very rare incident occurred, society jumps very quickly to recalls and getting the word out and letting people know. We are very protective as a society. And so it is so interesting that somehow when it comes to vaccine science, there's a shift. How do you call it?
Yeah, it's a miracle.
The
really
miracle
eradicated
effect.
Diseases.
Right.
Yeah.
So there,
and they don't want to give, they don't want to give up that idea that it was a miracle. And they're very willing. People look at what people did with Ritalin. I mean, the first ADHD kids were immediately put on medication. Now, finally, you know, 30 years later, we're looking at it and saying, you know, maybe this is not such a great idea. We're losing kids to suicide. We're losing kids to, you know, drug addiction. Maybe we should think a little bit before we put a child on a behavior-altering drug.
So I'm going to come back to white lies later. Because I do have a few more questions for sure about that. But right now, I think I'd like to segue into your other book that I have read here, which is Catcher Caught. So the title is Catcher, Caught. And why don't you tell us real quickly what this novel's about?
Well, again, I that wasn't a particular person that inspired me to write that story, but I was reading a lot of articles in the newspaper, and there was a particular case in Virginia that was a very high profile of a teenager who got leukemia, and his parents didn't believe in the traditional treatment. And it was the same time that the young woman in Florida, they were trying to decide whether to take her off life support. And there were all those articles about how much control does a patient have when a patient is under a disability, even a disability like AIDS, like being a minor. Mm-hmm. How much does a patient get to dictate what their medical treatment is, and how much control should parents or family members have? And so that issue, that controversy, was interesting to me. And then I had two boys of my own and their friends, and a friend stayed with us and spent high school years with us. And I had three brothers, and I just think teenage boys are a fascinating conundrum of bravado and terror. And I thought it would be interesting to write a story about a 16-year-old boy who was that boy that I, like the boys I knew, who was so loyal and brave and affectionate, but thought he knew everything but didn't really know anything, confronted with his own death when he shouldn't be, when he was only 16.
And so you have an excerpt that you'd like to share with us from Catcher Caught.
Sure. So Daniel is 16, and he has leukemia, and he's just read The Catcher in the Rye. And it's his voice, and he's telling the story. So he starts with the first paragraph I'll read you, and then I'll go into this other excerpt. Mm-hmm. When I first met Holden Caulfield, I didn't know I was dying. He's way more cool than me, but I like how he tells what it's like to be him, straight out, real. And even though his story is lots more exciting, I'm going to tell you mine anyway. It may be the last thing I do. Daniel Solstice Landon, that's me, soon to be dust.
Hmm.
So then this is another chapter later when he's telling you a little bit about how he's sick or why he's sick.
Mm-hmm.
So leukemia, here's the real story. You feel lousy most of the time. You turn into a total dud. Sleeping helps you forget. Trouble is, you wake up with no more energy than when you got in bed, and you don't forget for long. You get real skinny and weak. You have to drop out of every public activity because you're too tired, or other people's parents act like you have cooties, or you're just sick of answering their questions. And when they pat your shoulder, you're sick of trying to smile instead of sinking your teeth into their hands. The doctors sit around and shake their heads like they don't really have a clue what works and what doesn't. Then they say what they say to every other cancer patient. He needs chemo. She needs radiation. As if everyone's supposed to know exactly what that means. And hop right to it, like it's cotton candy or a free roller coaster ride. It feels like you're living in some sci-fi movie, Star Wars, AOL at the Mayo Clinic. Continuous four-syllable words roll off their tongues, words you've never heard before. all that flash and burn technology, the next thing you know, you start feeling hopeful. Someday soon, they'll be able to slide you through a metal tunnel and regenerate your old body with a new one, pure and whole, like a starfish. That's the myth they want you to believe, and it's tempting. Let me tell you how it really works. First, they tell you you're sick. Duh. You're supremely aware of that fact from the way you feel. Then they run you through every machine in the hospital, sometimes more than one hospital. They take samples from all kinds of weird places with super long needles and photograph every single part of your body, and they share the pictures with every doctor and nurse in a 100-mile radius. Privacy? Ha! Privacy means nothing to those know-it-alls. After that, they send you home, and you still feel lousy. Your parents stay up nights arguing and throwing things. It goes on for weeks and weeks. They get angrier. You get sicker. That makes them even angrier. Then when you finally wake up and realize it's not some movie, it's for real, you get angry. But you still have to do your homework and pick up your clothes. And if you have parents like mine, they don't trust the doctors because those same doctors are part of the corporate machine tied to the big bad pharmaceutical companies who are all in league with the government with a capital G. So El Parentos refused the advice and talked to lesser-known gurus who live in the Andes Mountains or the Yucatan about natural remedies, and you end up eating boysenberries pureed with rare duck eggs. Leukemia sucks.
Oh, God.
So that's Daniel. He's mad.
Yeah. Oh, okay, and that is exactly why I was nervous about it. Catcher Caught sat on my bookshelf for a while. I was like, oh, I don't really want to read about, you know, a beautiful young teenager who is facing an untimely death. And it was like, what actually happened for my family is that we experienced a death in our family, which really brought Daniel, your young protagonist, brought him to the fore. I knew I had to get together with him and I had to read this book and I had to experience this because several months ago, my brother-in-law died on the operating table during a relatively safe surgical procedure. I mean, it was supposed to be no big deal except for one strange condition, which is that he was a devout Jehovah Witness. And he had finally, after many months, found a doctor who was willing to accept all the required paperwork to prevent him from giving him a blood transfusion. And this was dealing with, you know, kidney cancer. So there's lots of blood vesicles in that area, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not going to go into the details of that, but there was this he was like one of the sweetest brothers in the family. It's a very large Mexican family. And so there was so much grief around the perception of an unnecessary loss of this beloved brother-in-law because of his personal convictions or his personal choice, which was outside of the box. Mm-hmm. He left behind two beautiful, very young boys and a wife. And so it just immediately I'm like, okay, I am going to go read this book now because that's what they're dealing with is, you know, what do you do when you've got your own feelings and there's the standard way of doing things. And it was a fascinating read. Very difficult area of human decision-making, medicine.
And it's meant to be a celebration of family. I mean, Daniel, it comes from a functional family. They just happen to have this distrust of the medical establishment, and Daniel has to figure out how to deal with that. But he has friends and he has people that he meets, and he has Holden Caulfield to kind of bounce ideas off of. And so he comes to some decisions that are very hard, but the book in itself is really a celebration of the bravery of young people and the strength of family.
I agree. It's a great read. So it's Catcher Caught for our listeners to look up later. I'll talk about more at the end of the interview. So you said that your novel Catcher Caught is being used in schools.
Yes, they are. The teachers are, apparently the kids nowadays think Holden Caulfield is a little whiny. What's the big deal, Holden? So you got kicked out of a prep school, so you can't talk to your father. That's not such a big deal.
Mm.
And so the teachers say, you know, this is nice how we can use Catcher Caught. They read 21st century issues, and then they understand the concepts that Salinger so brilliantly introduced when he wrote Catcher in the Rye, mm-hmm. the unreliable narrator. And the way that you don't really know till the end that Holden Caulfield doesn't really know what's going on. He's telling you later, with a perspective that doesn't have all the information. And mm-hmm. Daniel has the same problem. He doesn't really know why his parents are doing what they're doing, but he still has to deal with it. So
right.
It's the Penn Faulkner Foundation chose it for their Writers in Schools program, so they set up classes with the teachers where the teachers want to use it, and then I go and talk to the high school kids about it and about Catcher in the Rye, and it makes for a good program, and it extends the life of the book, which is very nice for me.
Yeah, excellent. Well, my copy, I may loan it to Danny Rock, the local high school principal, and mention that he may want to, share it around with his teachers. Who knows? Maybe you'll have an excuse to come visit Vashon Island.
Great.
That'd be great. So before I jump back to White Lies, could you tell us just real quickly about some of your other published work? And you just came out of a retreat where you were revising. So why don't you tell me where you're at and what else you have out there?
Okay. Well, I go once a year to Florida when it's cold in Virginia, and I hide out and I write I write the next book. And so I've done that for 4 years now, and so I've had a new book ready to go. And then the new one just came out at the end of February, which I wrote last year, and it actually took me a couple of years to write, which is longer than it usually does because it was too close to home. It was the story of a little boy who drowned in front of me and his sister and my cancer, my year of cancer treatment and recovery myself. And so mm-hmm. it was just too, I should have waited a little bit longer before I sat down to write it. I think it just took me longer to write it than I hoped for. But this year I wrote a fun one, another fun one about a widower who can't get over losing his wife, and he eventually takes a job at the landfill and discovers they're throwing away perfectly good books, so he starts lending them out, and he makes new friends and gets involved in their problems. So it's much lighter.
Yeah, you needed that, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. Okay, so at the end of the interview, I'll remind everyone of where they can find more information about your lovely books. So this is Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on Voice of Vashon at voiceofvashon.org. My name is March Twisdale, and I'm talking today with Sarah Collins Honenberger, who's calling in from, are you in Virginia right now?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. What's the weather like over there?
Well, it's sunny, but it's still cold, and we can't get out in our gardens yet, and we're frustrated because sometimes we get a nice warm week in March, but we haven't had it this year.
Right. Yeah, we had a nice sunny couple of days. I think it was like last weekend, and then it was torrential. It was raining horses and carriages and houses rather than cats and dogs. So coming back to White Lies, a tale of babies, vaccines, and deception, which once again, I'm going to offer that caveat that you are trying to find the delicate balancing point between appreciating vaccines for all that they have done for modern society, while acknowledging that these powerful medical tools are not perfect and they are oftentimes newly on the market or still being developed or researched and studied. In fact, I was just looking at a website in Australia. They Public Health has a great webpage talking about all the different types of adverse reactions and how important it is to report to your doctor if you have an adverse reaction, because this allows them to do ongoing studies into the safety and efficacy of a vaccine. So the government, the vaccine makers, the medical community, they all really get it that science evolves and that we don't have the answer, we have the current answer, and that a new and better answer is always around the corner if we keep looking for it. But sometimes what they know and what the people get to know is different. And so a lot of times there's just seems to be a big gap between what we hear in simplified public messaging and what the people involved in creating vaccines would actually be talking about over coffee. And so I wanted to run through a number of confusions or issues or things that I've noted in the media or in common conversation with people, and just sort of check in with you on these different areas of confusion that seem to exist in our society. For example, one thing that comes up, it is so quickly on the tips of people's tongues, it blows me away, is the assumption that people that go to the vaccine court because they have a vaccine-injured child, that they are frauds looking to game the system.
Yeah, it just can't happen with the system the way it's set up. You have to show the medical link, and you have to have the injuries that are accepted reactions and known reactions. So, and then that money is put in a trust fund for the injured child, and it has to be monitored. It's monitored by the court. It has to, you have to file annual accountings. And if you're using state facilities to help you take care of the child, nursing homes or training centers or, you know, medical hospitals, the money goes back to the state when the child dies. So there's, it's not like a personal injury action where you get in a car accident and you could hype your injuries and pretend you had a stiff neck. Or, I mean, there's just no way that that could happen with a vaccine compensation claim because of the way the process is set up and the kind of medical records you have to have. So that's really a falsity that wouldn't happen. It can't happen. The families that are injured are going to get a little bit of help, but they're not going to make millions of dollars, and they're not going to get to spend the money on vacations in Aruba. It has to be spent on the child's needs.
Right. Yeah. And when you win your, so you covered a couple of my other questions, so I'm going to skip to number four here. When you win your case in vaccine court, if that's what you want to say it, are you required to, I've heard this and I don't even know if it's true, I'm curious, are you required to sign like a gag order or give up your rights to describe the details of the award? Some people have said that and I'm like, really?
I don't know that. It certainly wasn't true in our case, except that to the extent that you settle your case, instead of wait for the special master to issue the ruling, it might be part of an agreed settlement that you wouldn't discuss the terms.
Right.
And that's simply because the amount of money that you're awarded is based on a special witness who comes in a second part of the proceeding and testifies to what the daily care requirements are going to be for this particular child's injuries. And in that regard, you might be able to present, like my client, Lacey, was not very sophisticated, and she didn't have a very sophisticated plan, and the child had been in the state hospital already for 20 years, and there was no way to really assess what the state was spending. So that was, we didn't have a lot of evidence about what it would cost. If you were going to keep a child in your home and you had been doing it for the 3 years or 2 years or 3 years of the litigation, you would know what the nursing care cost you and you would have those details. Mm-hmm. So I think they just don't want it. That's very particular to a particular child's injury and a particular child's care. And so it wouldn't be the same in every case. And so I think to that extent, they don't want you, if you agree to a settlement, instead of wait for the judge to decide. But if the judge decides, it's a public record, and you can't, I mean, there wouldn't be a gag order on a judge's decision.
Okay. I'm good. I'm glad to clarify that, because I had never, when I'd heard that, it was sort of like people were feeling, you know, maybe suspicious or untrusting. And I just remember thinking, but this is the federal government, so I would have hoped that wasn't happening. So good to hear. So in Lacey's case, I think you explained that the award is put, like you said, in a trust fund for her son, and upon his passing, when he eventually passes, that is that at that point the state will go ahead and be back paid, or you know, they'll
beneficiary. Well, they'll be the beneficiary of what's left in that fund, and it's of course it's well invested, and so it's actually grown, even though we spend money every year when he needs a new wheelchair or he needs a different kind of a bed or that kind of thing. We can spend the money on that kind of thing, but there's really very little we can do for him. His life expectancy was 9, and he's 43, and he has an IQ of 4. Mm-hmm. He can't feed himself, although he can tell you if he doesn't like the food, he'll spit it out.
Mm-hmm.
He recognizes his mother's voice when she comes. His head goes up. But otherwise, he sits in a wheelchair, and he can't do much, and mm-hmm. there's not much you can do for him. Mm-hmm. Very sad.
Yeah. So could you, in a nutshell, explain, explain to our listeners how the social contract was fulfilled through the 50s, the 60s, the 70s? Just sort of like give a sense of how that social contract was fulfilled prior to the vaccine court being created in 1986, and how the government is attempting to fulfill the social contract with people who are injured by vaccines in today's day. What's the shift that we've seen there?
Well, I think the biggest shift is that people expect their government to do more for them, and they don't and they've forgotten that their government is really them. I mean, government is us. I mean, we send those representatives there. We vote for them. We campaign for them or against them. And then they're supposed to be making decisions based on what we've indicated we want to happen. And more, people expect the government to take care of them. And when the government imposes a burden, like says you can only drive 55 miles an hour, and if somebody's speeding, we're going to give them a ticket to protect you, it's the same thing with the vaccines. As they've developed this medicine and required it in order to go to school, then they say, we're going to take care of you. And that, I think people expect that more. And so it's more of a outrage when they don't, if they're requiring you to pony up. They're requiring you to put your child on the line and have the vaccine. Then you really do expect that they'll be there to help you when you have a damaged child that you can't take care of all by yourself.
As an ex, it is really fascinating the position that the schools have been placed in. It's like, you know, they're really being used almost as it's a tool, it's a screening system. It's like, and in our state of Washington, we have still legal rights to, we have very good homeschool law, so you can homeschool if you want. We have all three exemptions are available, medical, philosophical, and religious. And but I believe Mississippi has no exemptions whatsoever, maybe not even the medical. I mean, I would imagine they should have at least that one, but they're a really extreme state. There are examples where like children are taken away from parents who aren't willing to vaccinate as if it's a form of abuse, or like there was recently a court where all these parents had to line up and they were ordered by the judge in a court, you know, line up and go get your vaccine. So it's becoming like, to me, it has overtones of totalitarian type of, you know, control. And I'm like, wow, these are medical decisions. And so this fascinating line that vaccines play.
Well, I think the doctors would tell you if you've seen a baby with whooping cough, you would be horrified. And the baby struggles and can't, you know, it's hard for the baby to survive with whooping cough. I mean, there's this push and pull of individual rights versus society's rights. Mm-hmm. And that social contract is evolving. Certainly the homeschooling contracts have evolved. I mean, when people started homeschooling, you didn't get any benefits from the public school system. Now your kids can play sports on the sports teams. They can take driver's ed because you're paying taxes too. And even though you're choosing to educate them at home, they still should be allowed the social part of that education that their tax dollars are paying for.
Right. Well, homeschool kids are accorded the same rights to access the educational system as a child who's fully there. Yeah, so it's never like there's nothing special that homeschoolers get that's given to them. They're just still given access to what all of the public school kids have access to.
But they weren't at the beginning.
No,
you weren't enrolled in that school, you were not allowed in that school. You could not come in to use the computers or play sports or play. I mean, it was not, and it was a situation that had to evolve because people had to talk about it.
Yeah.
So talking about it is good.
Exactly. Yeah. More information, more conversation. So, Sarah, I would like to end our interview with the excerpt from White Lies that you prepared for us. And so you want to go for that?
Sure. This will just show you how Lacey is as a person, and it will give you an idea of what a family would feel with an adverse reaction. It's the very beginning, chapter one.
Okay.
Lacey. In the shadowy place of my memories, Danny stays small and blue-eyed, sweet and happy. I've been over it and over it 1,000 times. There's always something missing, some piece of the puzzle I can't quite figure. That June morning in 1969, I remember how he grabbed the spoon with his fingers, tugging eagerly. You'd have hardly known he had a fever, except for the little crying fits like someone was pinching him. When I'd called Doc Snowden's office the day before, his nurse Mary said, if Danny wasn't back to his old self in the morning, call again. Although the days blur together, he spent weeks on end in the hospital in 1969. The day of that first seizure is the one day I can't forget. He was 3 months old, his hair already starting to curl like Scott's. I remember thinking when he grew up he would be handsome and smart, thanks to my brand new college-graduated husband, and brave and kind because I'd make sure of that. Was I nutty about that baby? Oh, yeah. A baby of my own was the one thing I'd wanted since I was a little girl. I know what they say about infants and gas, but that morning when Danny raised his head, he was definitely smiling. I only left him for a minute to mix his cereal, maybe not even a minute. He sputtered a little bit, coughed. But after that cough, there was no noise at all. And when I rushed back to the living room, he was gasping for air, his legs sticking straight out from his knees like a broken jackknife. His face had gone all white, and he was making scratchy sounds as if he were scrabbling up a boulder. Just as he started to slide out of the baby seat, I grabbed him, pounded his back, yelled for help. But when I put my finger on his tongue to keep him from choking, like they showed us in baby class, he clamped down and wouldn't let go. On the landing, I banged on doors. Out came George, the apartment manager, half-dressed, looking for the fire. I'm standing there in my nightgown, screaming like a lunatic. He grabbed my elbow and pulled. When my finger popped loose, Danny wheezed as if there weren't enough air in the world. George drove us straight to the hospital, ran every light, on the median strip, honking the whole way. And right before the emergency doors, he scraped a parked car, but that didn't slow him down any. Weird, isn't it, how a person's brain works? Despite all that panic, I can see the color of his car and the slippers I was wearing. 21 years later, that's what sticks, that yellow car and those red slippers. Like a hand in front of the sun, they keep my mind from the rest of the memory, the feel of Danny's legs dangling against my stomach and the sight of his eyes rolled back and his skin turning blue. His eyes were open, but he never blinked. The nurse grabbed him right out of my arms and walked away without saying a thing. You'd think in a big city hospital there'd be a ton of people, ambulances and doctors rushing around, but that hospital was like a funeral home. No noise, nothing moved. And on the floor, there was a single line of black tile. One line in a great wide ocean of white, winter everywhere. Not a real color, just cold, cold enough to drown in. It was July in Virginia, for God's sake, and I was frozen. Over and over, I mixed that stupid oatmeal, and I heard that sound when he stopped breathing, but I couldn't step across the damn line.
That's yeah. That's reminding me of everything in this fabulous book. You are such a good reader, Sarah.
Thank you.
I mean, you know.
My brother's a librarian. I can read upside down.
There, okay. Well, yeah. I mean, you're like a great writer. I've really enjoyed your writing. There's lots of writers who are not great readers. You're good at both. So,
thank you.
Okay. So let's
thank
see.
You,
yeah. My pleasure. Thank you so much. I do actually have one final question, which I ask all of my authors. For all of our listeners, but especially for parents and those in positions of authority who bear the burden of advising those parents, what takeaway message would you like to share with them?
If you run into an expert who won't talk to you and give you the answers you need, find another expert. There are lots and lots of people who know this subject and know any subject, and more information is always better than less information.
There you go. Thank you for talking with me today, Sarah. For those interested in learning more, you can find Sarah Collins Honenberger's contact information at voiceofvashon.org/prose-poetry-and-purpose in the on-demand section of our new website. Her new novel, Minding Henry Lewis, was recently released, I believe, in February. Right, Sarah?
Right.
And if you teach or have children in high school, you might want to consider the benefits of bringing Holden Caulfield and Daniel Landon of Catcher Caught into their lives as examples of the ever-present complexity we find in humans century after century. Sarah, I so very much appreciate your willingness to share yourself, your time, and your work with the rest of us.
Thank you, Marsh. It was my pleasure.
Check out her website at www.catchercaught.com. That's catcher like a person who would catch a ball. Or, of course, visit the on-demand section. My name is March Twisdale, program host and producer. If you have a favorite author who inspires you to believe in yourself and the future, who you'd like me to interview, send me an email at marchpower@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. Special appreciations to the amazing, talented, and generous volunteers who make Voice of Vashon the wondrous local radio station that it is, and to all of my guest authors for their passion, which sustains them as they spend years writing novels which we read over a weekend. And now, here is our island's own Cami Lundin and her fabulous title song, Run Free, one more example of inspiration through art.
Runs in the mountains like the sun sets beyond the sea, like the wind blows through the trees on a crisp autumn evening, wild and free. It can't be caught, it can't be tamed, it cannot be held still. It can't be touched, it can't be felt, it can't be stolen away. And be who you were made to be. Run wild and find the beauty that hides inside. Like the moon floats in the clouds above, like the bird soars in the endless sky, like the thunder that rolls out of sight on a stormy night. Why?